guest, actually, you and seven guests would enjoy a world-class chef-prepared dinner paired with Jaffe Wines at the Jaffe Estate, including a tour of the night sky led by Gary Jaffe himself and the Jaffe Estate's custom family observatory, plus a magnum of Jaffe Metamorphosis. That's item number 7311 right now, krcb.org, or you can tune in to the KRCB Wine and Epicurean Auction going on right now on KRCB Channel 22 until 11 o'clock and all this weekend long from 6:30 to 11. The time is 7 o'clock. It's time for Mouthful.
You better come on in my kitchen. There's hard to be running out the door.
Come over here, kid. Why, son? You never know, you might have to cook for 20 guys someday. You see, you start out with a little bit of oil, and you fry some garlic.
It's
and you throw in some tomatoes, tomato paste, you fry it, you make sure it doesn't stick. You gotta do a boil, you shove in all your sausage and your meatballs. And a little bit of wine. And a little bit of sugar.
Delicious.
And that's my trick.
When the moon hits your eye like a big pizza pie, that's amore.
Enough. I'm so sick and tired of hearing you people talk about food, food, food. That's all anybody ever talks about is prosciutto, cheese, and fava beans. I'm drowning here.
Jesus Christ, take it easy.
We're not even engaged yet.
When you're married, you'll understand the importance of fresh produce.
I eat with gusto, damn your bet. My country, 'tis of thee. I eat for social progress. I eat for victory.
Good evening and welcome to Mouthful, the Wine Country's most delicious hour. How are you doing this evening? Did you make it to a farmer's market today in spite of the rain? I was there in Sebastopol, and Princess Aisha, who was had cooked up, she'd spent all night cooking some of her traditional African food and had her van loaded up with drums and all the musicians coming to meet her and the dancers, and they were going to do. She's an amazing dancer, Princess Aisha, from Ghana. And it was raining so hard, she gave food to all of the vendors, packed up the car, and they left, and she will be back to do this again next, or to actually do it. So it's been postponed if you went there, because I wrote about it in my column. If you went there Sunday looking for Aisha, she'll be there Sunday dancing and serving up some really good stuff. She's the only person on the planet who can make me like peanuts. Her peanut sauce is truly amazing. Well, we've got two topics tonight. We're going to do just like we did last week, where we'll have talk about a current event, something that's coming up next weekend, and then we'll have the rest of the hour with our visiting author. We have in the studio with us Jeff Potter, author of Cooking for Geeks, Real Science, Great Hacks, and Good Food, just out from O'Reilly, whose home offices are here in Sebastopol. But first we have Jason Weiss, who is, if I have it correct, the co-CEO of the Boys and Girls Clubs of Central Sonoma County. Did I get it right?
You got it right.
Cool.
Thank you. Yeah.
And Pinot on the River.
Yes.
Is coming up.
It is.
On.
It's October 23rd and 24th.
Yeah, it's 2 days.
It's 2 days.
Next Saturday and Sunday.
We have a Taste of Pinot on Saturday night, and that's going to be held at the Hotel Healdsburg, and is going to feature 11 great Pinot Noir makers and their wines, and then, of course, fabulous food by Charlie Palmer's Dry Creek Kitchen.
And what was the structure of that event? Is it a walk-around event?
It is. It's a walk-around event. We will have the wineries will be pouring. Just last week, we sat down with the chef there at Dry Creek Kitchen and tasted some of the wine, and they decided on the different food that they're going to have. And so they're going to have appetizers, they're going to have past hors d'oeuvres, they're going to do entree stations and dessert stations. It's just going to be a lot of great food and a lot of great wine.
Mm-hmm. So that's Saturday night.
That's Saturday night, and along with that, it all benefits the Boys and Girls Clubs mm-hmm. of Central Sonoma County, and we will also be holding. We'll be auctioning off some of the wine from
that
some
night,
of the
Saturday
winemakers
night.
That night, mm-hmm. And then we've got some great wine kind of experience, wine country experience mm-hmm. packages that will be auctioned off as well, and it should just be a wonderful night. The next day is Sunday. day is the Pinot on the River Day, and that's about almost 100 Pinot makers at Rodney Strong Vineyards, and they will be tasting wine. There'll be some food there as well, and then we also are going to be running a silent auction there as well. That's also going to benefit the Boys and Girls Club.
Do you know what year this is?
This is, I believe this is the eighth year of Pinot on the River. Eighth. Yeah, and this is the second year that the Boys and Girls Club is participating.
Oh, okay.
And it's the first year we're doing the Saturday night event. We're kind of gearing that as a kickoff event for the weekend.
Tell us about the organization, because I noticed it's Boys and Girls Clubs, so it's more than one.
It is more than one. Yeah, a couple years ago, three Boys and Girls Clubs, separate organizations in the county, the Rohnert Park, Windsor, and Healdsburg Clubs, joined together as one organization. And since then, we have opened Boys and Girls Clubs in Southwest Santa Rosa. We've also opened up in Cloverdale. And actually, tomorrow, we open up in Geyserville.
You know, there isn't one in Sebastopol, is there?
There's not a Boys and Girls Club in Sebastopol. We've talked to people about the idea of doing that. So it's definitely, it's our goal to have a club in every community that, that wants one or needs one. And we provide after-school programs to over 1,000 kids a day.
Mm-hmm. So, and I was just going to ask you, what do you do?
Yeah. So
they come after school.
They come after school. It's our mission to inspire and enable youth to be responsible and productive adults, and we have a special emphasis on kids that really need it most. So we charge very low fees, if any fees, for kids to come every day after school. And we focus on academic success, good character, healthy lifestyles. All of our programs kind of fall into that, those categories.
And what kind of programs are they?
Well, everything from we have a program that we call Smart Moves that's a kind of a program that deals with peer pressure and negative influences for kids.
So it's a sort of a discussion group?
Yeah,
atmosphere?
Exactly. Okay. Exactly. We have our Power Hour homework program that gets kind of incentive for kids to get their homework done every day. So every child that comes to the club does their homework every day. We have programs like Torch Club, which are youth service clubs within the club, and kind of call it like a junior rotary or junior service club, and they elect officers, and they do club service and community service. We certainly do a lot of programs around art, and we certainly do recreation as well.
I was wondering if you did anything physical.
Yeah. You know, in the old days, the old boys clubs used to be much more recreation.
Go play basketball.
We used to call it swim and gym, you know, and since then, we've realized we've got these kids. We have these kids in these clubs for a good period of time. So what else can we do with them? And we still do the recreation, but we also have kind of a broader focus now too.
And it just seems like these days, with all of the talk about childhood obesity and the statistics, it seems like that physical component's really important.
It really is, and that kind of fits into our healthy lifestyle area. And we do a lot of discussion. We serve a healthy snack every day. A lot of our clubs do cooking programs, and we've had some guest chefs come in.
I'll tell you, if you open one in Sebastopol, I'll come be a guest chef.
All right, perfect. We'll sign you up.
Sebastopol
for sure.
Means something.
It does, yeah.
And what ages do you serve?
We serve kids from all school age kids. So you know, as young as kindergarten age through seniors in high school.
Wow, that's great. I didn't realize it was that young.
Yeah, we have some of our own facilities that are our own buildings, and we're also on school sites, but we have also teen clubs, and so we run the gamut. We do all the school age kids. Mm-hmm.
So it's Rohnert Park, Windsor, Healdsburg, Geyserville, and Cloverdale.
And Santa Rosa.
Oh, and Santa Rosa. Yeah. Oh, that's right. You said West Santa Rosa.
Yeah, we opened up about a year and a half ago in the Roseland area, and we now have three Boys and Girls Clubs in that area.
Oh, three, wow.
Yeah, on school campuses.
So a school will sometimes host?
Yeah, so sometimes we get some funding that allows us to do that, and so we're at the Roseland Elementary School and the Roseland Accelerated Middle School, and, you know, that's an area that really needs those types of services, and we're just bursting at the seams there. And traditionally, we don't like to turn kids away, but we've gotten close at a couple of those places,
Times are tough right now financially, so what do you do? Where are funds available?
Yeah, well, certainly an event like this is very helpful. You know, all, like I said, all the proceeds from the Saturday night event go to the Boys and Girls Club, and then all the auction proceeds from Sunday go to the club. You know, we work hard. We are always looking for funding. A lot, most of our funding comes from private donations.
It does, okay.
So it's, you know, individuals and corporations and private foundations. So we do a lot of work, you know, with our donors, and we have a great group of donors and always looking for more. And
so you have people who will like almost subscribe to support you or agree to support
you. I think we have some very regular donors and you know, I think we have a really good model. We joined these clubs together so that we could not have a redundancy in some of the
service. Not so much administration.
Right. And then we also, you know, by doing that, you know, in these tough economic times, we're expanding. Mm-hmm. You know, there's not, I mean, there aren't that many businesses and companies out there that expand during these times. And we've doubled, almost tripled in size.
That's great. And it seems like the need just grows all the time.
Yes, definitely. And that, you know, with tough economic times, the need grows even greater.
When you say,
Power Hour,
what motivates the kids to get their homework done? Do you guys help them?
We do. We do help them. We do, as part of Power Hour at a lot of our clubs, we have something we call Power Points. So they earn points getting their homework done.
Sure.
And then some of the clubs will do a store where they can turn their points in for, you know, Power Bucks or something like that and try to get them to, you know, so it provides a little bit of an incentive.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think kids have, you know, it's gotten to the point now where kids understand this is what we have to do, and and it's a huge help to parents. It's a huge help to the schools.
Absolutely.
You know, to the kids have, in most cases, have it done by the time their kids or their parents pick them up.
That's great.
Yeah.
That's great. So let's talk about how people get tickets.
Yeah. So
it's Taste of Pinot.
Taste of
Pinot. Night.
It's Saturday night. The tickets are $200 each. They're, you know, it's, again, it's 11 great wineries. Mm-hmm. We're really excited about the wineries.
Do you know off the top of your head?
Yeah. Well, we're really excited. We have Elysian, which is...
Okay, that's Gary Farrell.
That's Gary Farrell's new
He's
new
the guest
label.
I can never get on the radio.
Yeah.
I wanted him from 15 years ago when I started Mouthful. I wanted Gary, and Gary doesn't like to talk on microphones. So.
He's a great guy. His wife, Debbie, is amazing.
Yeah, Debbie and Gary are great.
Yeah,
tell them hi for me.
I will. They're going to be there, and they're... And this is only the second time I think they've poured this wine publicly. So we're really excited about that. And it's, I tried it the other day. It's fabulous. We're going to have McPhail Family Wine. It's going to be
really
there.
One.
Another great one. Small Vines is actually out in Sebastopol. Mm-hmm. It's kind of a new, I think they're kind of starting up. And then who else do we have? We have some
McPhail.
Papi Petro Perry is going to be there. So just a great wide range of wines. Landmark, Rodney Strong will be there also. So
you got a good line.
Yeah, we have a good variety. And you know, I was thinking about it with the price too. I mean, you'd spend a good amount of money for a good meal at Dry Creek Kitchen, and then you throw in 11 great wines on top of it. I actually consider it a deal.
So where do people get in? Can
if they
people buy
get,
tickets
yeah, they
up
can
to
buy,
the last minute?
They can. We tickets are available. The website is pinofestival.com, and they can buy tickets online, or they can call our office at 528-7977.
Okay, that's 528-7977.
Yeah, and it's extension 105 would be the best way, and that's Shannon, who's working with me on the the event, and it's there are still tickets available for Saturday night. There are also tickets for Sunday too.
Okay. And what's the cost on Sunday?
Sunday is $85.
$85. And what's the time on Sunday?
Sunday, I think it's 11 to 4. Saturday night is 6 to 9. We urge people to get there at 6.
Get there sure. Definitely
get there.
Get all
the wine and the great food, and we'll have about 20 minutes where we'll do a little bit of a live auction. We have a balloon raffle, bus raffle, and a lot of fun things to help support the club.
Mm-hmm. And so the tickets say pinofestival.com, and that number again, that number is 528-7977, extension 105.
That's it.
So next weekend, Taste of Pinot and Pinot on the River for a really good cause.
Great.
Thanks for taking time out
on your
Sunday
night. Thank you so much for
having.
No, it's a pleasure to be here.
Okay,
thank you.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
It's Mouthful, and yes, indeed, that was Roxy Music, Flesh and Blood. What does that have to do with Pinot Noir? You might say one of the things I like to do in my unlimited spare time is put together what we still call mixtapes. And I've done several Pinot Noir mixtapes because I love Pinot. And it always makes me think of Brian Ferry. You know, he's just the perfect Pinot Noir musician. We're changing subjects. Cooking for geeks, real science, great hacks, and good food. And I learned something really essential when I interviewed Jeff the other day over at O'Reilly on video. I hope it turned out okay. I was really sick when I did it. I hope I was still thinking clearly. But I was misunderstanding the idea of hacking. And you enlightened me, Jeff. So welcome to Mouthful.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
I never thought of hacking as taking something apart down to its essence and figuring it out in that way.
Yeah.
I just thought of it as like electronic break-in and entering.
Well, to a computer geek, that would be a cracking.
Oh, okay.
So you crack into a system and that would be illegal. But hacking would just be taking it apart and trying to figure out how that works. And
oh, interesting. Okay. That's really interesting.
Yeah, and whether you're doing that, you know, in front of the computer or in front of the frying pan, mm-hmm. it's still the same approach. Mm-hmm. How do you take this apart and understand the basic building blocks mm-hmm. of whatever system it is you're working with mm-hmm. and put it back together?
One thing I want to ask you before we get started, and we didn't talk about this on Monday. I know that you started cooking when you were a kid.
Yep.
What sort of palate do you have? Do you have the sort of palate where you can eat something and pretty much know everything that's in it?
You know, not really. I sort of wish I had a better sense of being able to guess and take things apart. I don't think I'm bad, but mm-hmm. I don't think I'm one of these people that can just take a single bite of something and go, oh, these four things, you know, combined with this, done this way, you know, I can't deconstruct it that way.
Can you taste something, go into the kitchen and fool around and come up with the same thing?
Yeah, sort of.
Okay.
It depends on how complicated it is.
So then you have a very intuitive palate.
I suppose.
Which is a good thing.
Yeah, sure.
That's a really good thing. I think that's one of the best thing. I think that really serves people who do what you do.
Yeah, well, I think it's really important for anybody who's going into the kitchen learning to cook is to really think what flavor really means.
Mm-hmm.
I had this really fun experience while working on the book, and actually even before, of doing basically a taste test where, you know, you get a friend to chop up and puree and dice, you know, maybe a dozen or two dozen different ingredients that you might, you know, normally use. But once you have those visual clues kind of removed and you taste them, you know, you start going, well, what is this I'm tasting? Let me step back for a moment and figure out if mm-hmm. I can really identify that label. And you'll taste something when you're doing one of these taste tests and think, oh, well, this is, I know this flavor. What's the word for it? And then they say, well, you know, that's cilantro. And you feel so stupid for not being able to get it. In my case, the one I remember being really stumped and puzzled by, which sounds so strange in hindsight, is hot dog versus ham. You know, I know these two things essentially are very distinguishable in our brains when we think about those two flavors. But somebody had served me a piece of hot dog they'd cut up, and it kind of looked like a piece of ham. I saw that much, and I tasted it, and I thought ham. And, you know, it was ham. And then we said, no, that's hot dog. As soon as he said hot dog, I, bam, there the rest of it was. And yeah, it was hot dog. I have no idea how I thought it was ham. I feel guilty and stupid for even sharing the story.
No. I think that's really enlightening because we do make assumptions with our eyes.
Absolutely, and texture, and so many
absolutely,
other things.
Absolutely, texture.
And when it comes to tasting something and thinking about what's in this, or mm-hmm. tasting something you're working with in the kitchen and thinking, what would this need? What would make this better? Mm-hmm. Being able to pull up those memories and think about them and label them, you know, it's surprising you. You know,
and plus, ham is a pretty broad term. I would bet that you would never, like, I think I know what kind of ham it must have been. Mm. It wasn't Smithfield, you know. It wasn't a nice dry cured ham
no.
from the South.
No.
So you, it was a commercial.
It's commercial ham, you know, thick cut Canadians, or it wasn't even Canadian. Which, you know, it was just whatever the local grocery store.
So it's got some acid in it. It's got a lot of salt. It's got a certain texture.
Yeah.
It's not that big a deal.
Yeah, thank you. I feel
okay.
better now.
Okay. Want to hear the geekiest thing I've probably ever done?
Sure.
When I was writing Salt and Pepper. You know, and there was not the array of salts that there are now. I mean, all these salt with cumin, salt with, you know, whatever. There wasn't that array, but there were probably had a good 30 salts. And I worked with an assistant, and we dissolved every salt in water. And she did it. She kept the key, and I tasted each one. And then wrote down. I didn't try to guess, but I wrote down the characteristics that I tasted in each one. And we did it by weight so that, there was the same, you know, not by volume, but by weight.
Definitely, you know.
And I still remember sitting tasting that drinking salt water for about 2 hours. I was insane.
I once tried some salt. This is back at NYU and Kent Kirschenbaum's Experimental Cuisine Collective back there. He was passing around a smoked salt. And he just passed it around for us to kind of take a look at and smell. But me being me, I'm looking at it going, well, I'll try a little, you know, just put a little grain in my tongue. Big mistake.
Really?
I had nothing to drink.
Oh.
Actually, the only thing we had were whiskeys.
Uh-huh.
A little whiskey sampler. So I literally pickled my tongue.
Oh, gosh.
It was really horrible. Like, I couldn't actually taste anything for 4 or 5 days. And at the time, I swore that I was like, oh, my God, I've shot my palate for the rest of my life. I'll never be able to taste again.
Interesting.
Don't try salt without some water around it.
Oh, yeah. You have to have some salt.
Dropping it in water makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. Yeah, well, partly because what happens then, if you drop it in water, you're not influenced by texture. You've seen if there's any real influence in the flavor, because so many salts are about the shape that you perceive.
Right, the flakiness versus other crystallization forms. Yeah, of course. Yeah.
How is the taste? Could you taste the smoked salt?
Yeah, it was delicious for the first 10 seconds,
yeah.
And then I tasted nothing for 5 days.
Days. But your palate came back, and all is good, and here's the book.
And here are the
books. What was the approach? What's if you had to write a thesis statement that summarized your book, what would it be?
Wow, quizzed live on the air. Ooh, I wasn't warned about this. Really, I look at it and think that, well, when I describe the book, I describe it as food science with recipes to illustrate that food science. So it's really about what happens in the kitchen, why it happens, and then trying to give an example of that so that you can apply it and take it into the kitchen and understand what that means. For so many people who did not grow up in an environment where their parents cooked, which many of people, my generation, I'm 32, they didn't have a family background that involved cooking. I got to college and I was surprised at how many people who I went to school with didn't know how to cook at all.
They probably didn't know how to boil water.
I had one guy actually ask me, how do I know when butter's melted?
that doesn't have anything to do with cooking. Can't you just tell whether you cook or not?
It has to do with turning the brain on when you walk into the kitchen. And, you know, going back to your opening question about hacking and what that definition is, hacking and, well, being a geek of any type really is about curiosity. It's about having your brain turned on and thinking, hey, how does this work? And once I understand how it works, how can I put this together in new ways? And so when, you know, somebody asks how's butter melting, they're just not thinking.
Send them out to the snow. How can you tell when snow's melted?
Right. Well, because it turns into a liquid, right? Butter is, of course, an emulsion, so we'll hand wave the details here and say, because, you know, it turns into a liquid.
Crudely put,
sure. from a very high level, the book really is, as much of anything, what's all that knowledge that we, who did grow up with backgrounds involving cooking, what's all that knowledge that we intuitively kind of learned, what's that look like? If you don't have all those, you know, trial and error type experiences over a decade or two to kind of learn how to cook, what is it I could tell you that would actually help you short circuit and shortcut that trial and error? So, you know, for me, when I got to college, I discovered I didn't really know how to cook dinner. My parents had taken time to show me how to make breakfast, and I, of course, as any kid, had a sweet tooth, so dessert was, you know, something I knew how to make. But when it came to thinking about, well, how do I cook this chicken, or what should I put with it, and not being the type of person who wanted to follow a recipe, it's just not my type of cook, you know, I tried lots of different things, and it took me kind of, I would say, the better part of a good decade to actually get to the point where I was comfortable just walking into a kitchen, you know, and throwing stuff in a pan and saying, yeah, this will work. I mean, I remember some of the early experiments back when I just got out of college, you know, salmon and spaghetti. It's doable,
but,
you know, it's not something that you would really think of.
Uh-huh.
But there was a period of time where I went through and did that. But if you could give somebody some sense of what's actually going on in the kitchen, then, you know, maybe they can get there quicker. And so the book really is about what is it we do in cooking? What's that bigger picture thing? And once you have that, whether you're new to the kitchen or whether you're an experienced cook who's never really thought about why I put certain things together, well, it helps you basically turn out a better dinner. When something goes wrong, you can correct it.
Correct it.
Or if you've got a particular idea, you can kind of take a guess of, I wonder if I do this, if that'll happen.
Mm-hmm. So let's sort of go a little bit backwards in that you said, the recipes are here to illustrate points that you make. So instead of starting with the points that you make, let's just have a little fun with a couple of the recipes and tell me what, you know, rice congee, for sometimes called juk. You have to say it right. Juk. I asked for juk when I was in Malaysia. Are there what? And I'm saying, you know, it's like, they're, oh, you mean juk.
So, right.
Well, it's a tonal language. So it's one of my favorite things in the world. And then we're coming up on juk season. Winter, it's a great breakfast.
Yep.
I love it.
Well, you know, in this case, it's really, this particular recipe is in the chapter that talks about flavor and how ingredients go together and trying to give the reader a sense of what techniques they might use to go into the kitchen and make their own combinations.
I really admire you for taking that on because I think that that is one of the hardest things to teach.
Yes, it might be. You know, kind of stumbled into this and hopefully I succeeded at this. But in this case with kanji, you know, every culture has its equivalent version of it.
Yeah.
You don't really think of it that way. But something like cream of wheat, you know, it's essentially the same process, just a different starch.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing with porridge.
Polenta.
Yeah, exactly. Every culture has essentially, you know, you take some sort of starchy grain, you throw it in water, you cook it for a while, and you get some sort of, well, cooked starch. I mean, the starches have heated up.
Porridgey thing.
Yeah, exactly. And then, you know, you can start looking at how do different cultures dress that up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, cream of wheat might be for breakfast a little bit of brown sugar or maple syrup, maybe some cream on top. Congee, it might be something, you know, like some soy sauce and some egg or some green scallion or ginger.
Or salmon.
Yeah, exactly. Actually, there's a really good restaurant in San Francisco I just had the other day for breakfast.
Where?
Samovar.
Oh, yeah, I love Samovar.
Yeah.
And also, Great Eastern on Jackson Street. But if you order it too early in the day, they say, no, it's not time.
I'll have to go there. That sounds actually like an interesting, good place. So, you know, in this case, with kanji, it's really thinking about, well, what happens if you start looking at the cultural roots of where different dishes come from? Now, keep in mind, this is just one recipe out of over 100 out of the book. And, you know, the book spans so much. So, you know, if somebody's listening and they think the entire book is going to cover this, I'd say there's probably 5 pages or 10 pages out of 400 and something pages that to talk about this particular slice of cooking.
Yeah, well, I just really wanted to, I did this at random, and I wanted
I enjoy it. I'm ready for the next one.
So, no, but I want to stay on this just a little bit more. How can we articulate that target of finding flavors that go together?
Are you asking why do certain flavors go together?
No, how do you teach for someone who's confused about the concept, how do you talk to them?
I tell them to start with combinations that they think of already as going together. So, you know, take pasta sauce. If you've got somebody who's just come through college, let's say,
they know spaghetti with marinara sauce,
yeah,
don't
exactly.
They?
So then go look at the jar of marinara sauce and see what ingredients in there.
Mm-hmm.
And then if you say, oh, this has got mushrooms in there, well, then go grab some mushrooms. Slice them up and saute them and toss it in with your pasta and your sauce. Because that's going to go together. We know the flavors are compatible. Maybe there'll be too much mushroom. Maybe the balance won't be right.
Mm-hmm.
But you can kind of start understanding what flavor combinations and where the balance points might be.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in the case, you could then kind of take it a step further and say, well, you know, fresh veggies of any sort kind of sauteed might work well. Go get some squash and, you know, slice them up, and some carrots maybe, and, you know, add those in with your mushrooms and give that a try and see how that works. And maybe some veggies won't work. And you go and try And then you start going, oh, that one didn't work so well. And you start building up this mental map of kind of what combinations work well and what don't.
Mm-hmm.
Flavor compatibility is actually really fascinating. A lot of it has to do with the actual chemicals involved and how similar these different compounds in different foods are.
Mm-hmm.
There's actually a great website done over in, I think it's Bernard Lajos, and I think he's in Brussels. It's Food Pairings.
Mm-hmm.
I think foodpairings.com will redirect you to foodpairings.be. And he actually looks at the chemistry of it. And
uh-huh.
you can give it any single ingredient, and he will show you a map of all the other foods that are chemically similar. And they might not always be traditional pairings, but they're pairings that the science at least suggests should be compatible. They might not be compatible from textural point of view, as they're from, you know, pure mechanics of being able to heat or having to heat one thing and not being able to heat something else without mm-hmm. destroying its flavoring compounds. But
you can just get like really, really geeky on this subject if you want to.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And of course, you know, I do. You know, you get these nice little diagrams if you go to a site. They look, you know, essentially like a single word, maybe the word chicken. And then off of that will be, you know, basically a cluster of different little words. In the case of chicken, it might say mozzarella and butter, or, you know, tomato asparagus, or soy sauce, or bitter orange peel, which isn't something I would think of going against chicken. But then again, actually, you know,
chicken all over orange.
Yeah. You know, so maybe not so crazy after all. So I don't think of fresh cut grass as going very well against chicken. But then again, I guess you've got chicken where you line it in straw and put that into a pot. And so, I mean, just as a way of, you know, kind of joggling all the neurons around and kind of getting some inspiration, it's an interesting approach. And it's actually, this particular approach is used by a number of the very mm-hmm. high-end restaurants in Europe. I mean, El Bulli, Fat Duck, these guys are using this approach as one way of getting to new places.
Mm-hmm. So now we're sort of just getting onto the shores of molecular gastronomy, aren't we?
Tiptoeing
towards there.
Yes. Maybe we can
tiptoe back out, dry our feet, get up on the heart, get up on the asphalt.
That's such a contentious issue in so many places.
Oh, yeah.
The analogy I like to draw with so much of the term I think I would probably use would be modernist cuisine, which is, of course, also the title of the forthcoming book by Nathan Myhrvold. I would probably compare it to something like fashion. You know, you think about the Paris runway, and you look at anything that's coming down that runway in any given year, and 98% of it is just like, what were they thinking? But 2% of it's brilliant. And if you only ever see that 98%, you just think, yeah.
And about 99.9% of it is unwearable in the real world.
Right, absolutely.
But about 2% of it's gorgeous.
Right, yeah, exactly. And, you know, I think that's probably true of anything out of the modernist cuisine era, movement, whatever, so far, just in the sense that, you know, time hasn't had a chance to kind of run through and filter out the stuff that isn't so good and leave behind just the few jewels that are probably in there.
There was a real interesting discussion a couple days ago, I think. You know Marcel Hazan, I assume, the Italian, the most brilliant writer on the food in English on the foods of Italy. Her book, Classic Italian Cooking, is something everyone should have on their shelves. And she's, I met her, it was a few years ago. She was here teaching a class over at Mondavi. And it's my great regret about my radio show in that I was very nervous. It was Marcela Hazan and all. I was supposed to record her like at 3, and all of a sudden she wanted to do it at 2. And I was new to portable equipment. I plugged the mic into the wrong jack and recorded this whole fabulous interview, and it wasn't there.
Well, you didn't record it.
I mean, I thought I recorded
it. Right.
I pushed the button, but it was in the... Anyway.
I did that with one of my interviews in the book.
Yeah.
And I had to call back and read it. I felt so bad.
It happens to us all. Anyway, Marcela, who is in her 80s now, and she's living in Florida, she is a firecracker on Facebook. I mean, I just started my blog at the end of July. I blogged through the Press Democrat that I write for. I needed to do a companion blog. And I think it was my second posting. There was Marcela leaving a response, and she took issue with absolutely everything I said. She did it exactly the opposite. And I sent her an email thanking her for posting. But she, I mean, she's very lively on Facebook. She's very opinionated. She has hundreds of friends. And I mean, she's just this wonderful conversationalist on Facebook. And somebody, I'll think of his name in a minute, has either written a book or a newspaper article comparing Ferran...
Adria.
That's right, Ferran Adria of Ibuli with Picasso and all these other people. And she was hilarious in the way she took it apart.
What was it? Yes, I think this was actually a New York Times article maybe about 3 weeks ago.
Something like that.
It wasn't that long ago.
No, it was very recently. Yeah. And it's a writer I know. I know who it is. He was the original editor of Sever. Coleman Andrews. And I'm pretty sure it's Coleman Andrews.
Okay. I'll take your word.
Anyway, it was very interesting to see the responses that everyone started posting after Marcella. Yeah. It's probably Marcella. Contentious.
Food is such a wonderful thing because we all eat.
We all eat.
So we all have opinions about what we eat, which means we all have opinions about what other people eat.
Yes.
And, you know, I look at it and think there's more than one way to do it. You know, there's an expression, if you happen to be a programmer that works with Perl, the expression's Tim Toady, which is there is more than one way to do it.
Okay.
And it's just the acronym. I look at it and think, well, you know, whatever makes somebody happy, if that's the way they want to approach it.
It's like going from here to San Francisco or here to Sebastopol. There's more than one way to get there.
Is there really?
Yeah.
I've only done one.
There's more than one way to get from here to Sebastopol. There's more than one way to get anywhere. Here you are, and there's your destination. It's the same with food. You know, here you are, and you want this to eat. Mm-hmm. Here's my way of doing it. You probably have a different way.
And
but we're both going to get there.
Right, and everyone's there isn't going to be the same exact point.
Yeah,
and,
absolutely.
You know, it might be some people want to go north, and other people want to go south.
There's that. One of the main points that seemed to be made in this article, at least in the discussion of this article, was that he wants you, he being Ferran, wants you to eat with your brain. And she just ripped into that. And I'm curious about your thoughts on that idea. And I'm curious if you did any investigation of the domestic scientist movement in the late 19th century. And if you didn't, it's fine. It's a very obscure little movement.
I didn't on the latter. But in the former question, just kind of eating with your brain, you know, I have two kind of thoughts there. One is, it's amazing how much of how we speak about food is cultural. So when someone like Ferran says that, we hear it out of our culture, but he's saying it from his culture.
Culture, which is, yeah, that's an excellent point.
And that's actually critical.
Yeah.
So in the book, you know, there's probably something on the order of 24 interviews. And I was very fortunate to have interviews with both Harold McGee and Hervé Tisse. You know, and Dr. McGee is, of course, one of America's favorite.
Oh, he's a great guy.
Yeah, absolutely. And Hervé Tisse, you know, is to the French, he is kind of a national treasure to them. But it's something that here in the U.S., we don't even have, you know, what's Hervé who?
Yeah,
it's kind of, you know, the average American response. Whereas, you know, in France, it's Harold who? Which, you know, to anybody with food here is kind of like, what do you mean? But both these people are, you know, within their cultures. They are who they are.
Mm-hmm.
But I think when you read through transcripts of Hervé and thinking about what he says, you lose that cultural layer.
Sure. And that's so important.
And that's
absolutely
critical. So if Ferran is saying, you know, please come to my restaurant and eat with your brain, that sounds very particular to me. But I bet you there's something there that's just a cultural thing. But that all said, it's a very long thing. I did say there are actually two kind of bits to my answer. The second bit would be how I look at reasons for going out and eating. When I first started working on the book, I kind of thought, you know, there being a model that was kind of two layers. The base layer being, well, we eat food because we're hungry and we need the nutrients for our body and, you know, all this. And then kind of the second layer above that being, well, you know, sometimes it's nice to go out and see other friends and have it be a social thing and have it be, you know, much more of a community thing. But I would say after working on the book, I realized there's a very, very thin third layer, which is really food as art. And we don't really think of food as art. And of course,
you're in Northern California.
Okay.
There are people
I take
here
that
who
back,
do.
Northern California. When I say art, yeah, I hear what you're saying.
But that has actually been a conversation that's been going on here for at least 3 decades.
Right. I was going to say, I mean, yeah. My entire life. I mean, I grew up in San Jose, so even though I live in Cambridge in the East Coast, mm-hmm. You know, that very thin layer, that very expression of art, to me, good art is something where when you come across it, you have a very strong emotional reaction.
Mm-hmm.
For me, when I go, if I go to, you know, the MoMA, you know, I remember going to the MoMA in New York actually a few years ago and walking around a corner and walking into this one room that had an installation, and talk about emotional reaction. For me, if I go to a museum and see one thing that just really does it for me, that's a great.
Do you have to leave then?
I'm happy. I'm full.
Exactly. I have the same exact relationship
right.
to art.
And
I can't eat anymore. Once I have that moment,
right.
I'm done.
I'm satisfied.
Yeah.
And I think that when looking at food, it's very hard to do that. Because if you look at things like modern art, as soon as you see a particular concept or piece done, well, you see it a second time and you've seen it before. It's no longer going to evoke that same trigger. So in the case of this MoMA piece that was a few years ago, you walk into this room. It's one of these large white gallery spaces. There's a guard standing there. There's a couple of people like just kind of staring at the wall, like looking very perplexed. And there's a couple other people in the room that are just like looking around going, what's going on here? And it took me a while to get it. The artist had taken a piece of semi-transparent fabric and stretched it floor to ceiling, left edge of wall to right edge of wall against one wall in the studio, which gave this effect where when you looked straight on it, you saw the real wall. But as you looked down the corridor of the wall toward the end, that wall faded out and disappeared. And a new wall materialized about a foot in front of it. It was something that just like, it made no sense. Your brain looks at this and goes, does not compute, does yeah. not compute, and just throws you for a loop. And then suddenly you kind of get it and you click and you go, wow. So that did it for me. I don't know why. It probably sounds very strange.
No, it doesn't. No, it doesn't sound strange to me at all.
So when looking at food and talking about this very, very thin layer of art on top of that, I think it's really hard to do that. We've all can look for, hey, you know, can I make an even better mushroom risotto? Or can I make an even better, you know, whatever it is mm-hmm. you're doing. But there it's almost kind of just effectively better iterations, but it's not revolutionary.
Mm-hmm.
And that going and taking something to a revolutionary point, I think is really hard.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, a lot of fun if you can get there.
Yeah. Now, one of the things you talk about in the book, one of the sort of experiments you talk about, I don't know if experiment's the right word. It's probably not. The whole slow cooker thing. I want you to tell that story because I think it's amazing. I love it.
You're talking about the do-it-yourself sous vide?
Yes, the do-it-yourself sous vide. And sous vide, of course, let's explain sous vide.
Sure. Sous vide is a French term. It's spelled S-O-U-S-V-I-D-E. It's essentially ultra-low temperature poaching. Now, when it comes to cooking and thinking about what happens when you add heat to food, certain chemical and physical changes occur. So if you take a piece of steak and you heat it up, it starts to cook. What's really happening with something like steak is different proteins actually cook and denature. Their actual molecular structure essentially with additional heat vibrates more. And as it vibrates more, it snaps out of its native conformation and changes its shape, which also changes its texture. With steak, there's a couple of different key proteins that happen to go through this process when we cook them. And those different proteins cook at different temperatures. So one of the first ones is myosin, and it goes around 122 Fahrenheit. And another important one is called actin, and it goes around 150 Fahrenheit. And if you look at what medium rare steak is essentially steak where the myosin proteins have cooked and the actin's native, 135 to 140 or so. And that's texturally preferred by most people who, mm-hmm. you know, when you do taste panels. If this chemical reaction with actin begins at 150, if you put that steak into an environment that's only 140 degrees, well, those reactions aren't going to occur. And what you will get, in fact, is a piece of steak that is cooked medium rare, center to edge, no gradient of doneness, just perfect medium rare.
And let's just for a second compare that to, say, broiling a steak,
mm-hmm.
where you have 500 degrees.
Right.
And you're trying to achieve rare, medium rare, so you have a gradation.
Right. You get a gradient of heat as the energy that hits the outside of that piece of meat transfers down through the meat towards the core of that meat.
Yeah, and if something happens and you're distracted, you can very quickly take it too far.
Absolutely. You can overcook it. And in fact, if you look at it, by the time the core is medium rare, everything beyond the core is more than medium rare and overcooked if you're trying to shoot for medium rare, which, you know, is fine. You get, you know, kind of the gradient. You get this, you know, bullseye thing where the middle is medium rare, then you get medium, medium well, well done, and then the outside is completely... Well, you know, it's cooked. With the sous vide method, essentially by dropping it into an environment that's 140 degrees, you avoid that reaction. Now, you also happen to avoid the outside kicking browned from the Maillard reaction, which doesn't really begin to visibly occur until 310 degrees or so. These aren't instantaneous temperatures or kind of rate at temperature and reaction type things. But you have to get the outside of that steak up to that temperature for that reaction to occur. You put that meat into an environment that's only 140. No reaction, no brown outside. So if you're going to cook this way, you take the product, whatever it is, if it's steak, you take the steak out, and then you drop it into something like a cast iron pan to heat up the outside. Mm-hmm. But you've basically taken the two variables of internal temperature and external temperature, and you've made them independent. So you cook it until your internal temperature is exactly what you want, and you cook it until the external temperature. Yeah,
15 seconds on either side.
Right, you know, just briefly. So this is traditionally done in a water bath. So you'll take a piece of food and you actually essentially submerge it in liquid.
Well, you put it in, you seal it in a bag.
It's traditionally sealed in a bag. This is to prevent the water from chemically interacting with that food. You can also shove marinade into that bag, which will press up against the meat and flavor it. And you can also use this technique for other things. Yeah. You know,
is there any reaction with the plastic?
You know, that's a question that comes up a lot. At 140 degrees, you're reasonably safe. If you look at things like Ziploc brand bags, the manufacturer, SC Johnson, says that their plastics are heat stable up to 170.
Okay.
And on top of that, they don't use BPA in their plastic bags. Okay. So if you read about BPA, well, there's none there to begin with.
Okay.
And at 140 degrees, you know, you're pretty low.
Yeah,
I mean, you have a problem with that food in a plastic bag, you know, at room temperature. We're not talking that much warmer than room temperature.
Mm-hmm.
It's not boiling water. You know, boiling water is an issue. That's 212 degrees.
Mm-hmm.
And things like LDPE, one of the more common malleable plastics, begins to melt like at 220. So at 212, some of the molecules are actually kicking off from that surface of the plastic and getting into the food. But at 140, it doesn't seem to be an issue. Now, if you're concerned about it, if you're going to try this, you don't have to use a plastic bag. You can just drop the food into the liquid. Or you can, instead of using water, you could, you know, use olive oil or some other liquid to transfer that heat. The only reason we don't use air in there is that air is not a very good conductor of heat.
Right.
So if you set your oven to 140 degrees, if you could, it would take, you know, 24 hours to cook that piece of steak, and you've got some microbiological issues at that point with food safety.
Yeah. So you drop it in, and then we should say that the circulator, the water circulators that they have in restaurants these days, are not cheap.
No, they're not. And, you know, this cooking technique, the sous vide stuff is... you know, it's actually first done in the 70s over in France and came here, and it's been done at a number of very high-end restaurants here in this country for the last 10, 15 years, you know, including French Laundry. You know, these guys are using what's called an immersion recirculator. It's essentially a piece of chemistry gear that's got a heating element, a thermocouple to measure the temperature of the water, and a little agitator to kind of move the water around so you don't have any cold dead spots in whatever the container is you're working with. But for home uses... it doesn't seem to be so critical to have that agitation.
Mm-hmm.
So there's actually a nice little hack you can do. and this is where, you know, if you're going to think about taking things apart and putting them together in new ways, well, here's a good example. You can take a slow cooker. Because a slow cooker is designed to hold a body of liquid at a certain temperature. The only issue with slow cookers is they tend to hold the liquid between 160 and 185 Fahrenheit. And with sous vide stuff, you need to actually keep the temperature range pretty precise depending upon what you're cooking.
Mm-hmm.
Things like eggs, you really need to keep around 145 to 150, let's say. It depends on your preference for how runny you like your eggs. And if you go too hot or too cold, you're going to basically either undercook or overcook your eggs. So what you do is you take your slow cooker and you basically bypass the circuitry in it. You set it to the high mode, and then you take your own external thermostatic controller. You can go and buy one for $70 or so on the internet, and you wire in your own thermocouple, and you drop that thermocouple into the slow cooker, and you plug the slow cooker into your thermostatic controller, and then set the slow cooker to high, and the thermostatic controller then cycles the power on and off on that slow cooker, and you have your own sous vide rig. Now, it doesn't have an agitator in it, so it's not going to be as precise, but it seems for most things, you know, I can't notice the difference.
Yeah, and you have all the details to do that.
Yeah, it's actually very straightforward to do. You know, one J-Love thermostatic controller and a thermocouple and a slow cooker and a pair of wire cutters, and you're there.
I just think that I just love this. I've been thinking about it ever since you told I learned about it on Monday. Just looking here at another recipe. Actually, tell me one of your favorite recipes in the book. Is that fair?
Sure.
We only had, I mean, we could talk for hours. You know, you're so articulate on this subject and so passionate. And I can be such a geek. So it's fascinating to listen to you. But
well, thank
we really
you.
Only have a few minutes.
Well, you know, for me, you know, there are recipes in the book that I enjoy a lot. But really, in so much, I really enjoy understanding why certain things happen. Mm-hmm. So let's take collagen, since you have the book flipped open to that page.
Okay.
Collagen is a really long protein. It's actually one of the longest proteins in the muscle tissue in the body. And it basically provides structure. So things like beef stew have a lot of collagen in them. Squid, you know, squid doesn't have a skeleton, but somehow it manages to have some sort of structure, and that's collagen, providing that structure. Now, collagen, unlike, say, the proteins I was talking about earlier, which essentially go from a native raw state to a cooked denatured state, collagen goes through two changes. The first thing that happens is that this molecule actually denatures, and then it hydrolyzes. And this is the secret to collagen. Collagen normally is a triple helix. It's this kind of complicated structure. These three different strands run in a helix, and then they have crosslinks between them. When it's in its native state like that, it's enjoyable. So you can take squid, cook it in a pan really quickly, a little bit of olive oil or butter, whatever you like, and it's delicious. And the heat from cooking with the olive oil or butter will essentially pasteurize or sterilize any pathogens that might be around, so you know it's safe. The problem is if you cook it too long, that triple helix structure unwinds, but all the crosslinks that hold the different pieces of those three different strands still exist. And so you get something that's very rubbery. And in fact, a material scientist will call it a rubber. It is technically rubber.
Rubber.
At that point.
That's right. So you have to cook squid really, really fast.
Or
a really long time.
And that's because it takes a long time for it to hydrolyze. And that's where the actual strands in that triple helix, where those strands get snipped up. And then you have all these small little pieces floating around. And without, you know, in the in-between state, no good. Once it's actually completely hydrolyzed and you let it cool back down, you get gelatin. That's where gelatin comes from. Yep.
And on that note, we are almost out of time. So I want to wrap it up. The book, again, is Cooking for Geeks, Real Science, Great Hacks, and Good Food. And if you've enjoyed our conversation, you're in for more if you pick up a copy of this book. It's really fun, and especially if you love to know how things work, and I love knowing how things work. I think it's really fun. You have a good website for the book.
I do.
It's just Cooking for Geeks. I was looking at that earlier today.
It's at cookingforgeeks.com. The book itself is available, of course, your local fine bookstores, also online, Amazon, and all your retailers.
What about through the website? What's the best way for you, for people to get it?
You know,
does it matter these days?
It doesn't really matter for me. Okay. I mean, you can certainly go to O'Reilly's website, and I think that they have a, you know, buy two, get three copy type deal. So, you know, if you want to do your Christmas shopping now,
there you go.
You know, I've had a number of people buy it thinking that it would be a good gift for their son or whoever. And they start reading it and they go, oh, I've got to get myself a copy too.
Yeah. It's really, really a fun book, but it's a fun book with depth. I mean, I think only really books with depth are fun. And this one has a whole lot of depth. And it's really interesting, and congratulations. And I hope you've had a good time. And I bet you're really ready to get back to Cambridge, aren't you?
I am. Thank you so much for having me.
You bet. And when you come back, come on again.
Sounds great. I look forward to it.
Okay, coming up on Mouthful next week, we've had some great writers, some great books that we've been able to feature these last few weeks, and we have another one coming up next Sunday. It is Marisa Gugiana, who's been on Mouthful at least twice before, president of Sonoma Direct. Her book, Primal Cuts, is out. It interviews I think it's 50 butchers, artisan butchers around the country. And it is a really, really great book. So don't miss next week's episode of Mouthful, the Wine Country's Most Delicious Hour. I'm Michelle Anna Jordan. Have yourself a great week.
Just say